Earth Apology by Hassan Rashid, first chapter, title, Prelude. With precious you, Earth, on the cusp of catastrophe, I have come to realize how we, the culprits, have somehow evolved to be this way. And I can't help but feel a deep sense of guilt and wonder as to whether the rest of the civilized peoples of this planet must feel just the same. After all, are we not sapiens, the wise ones who should learn to change our habits in order to accommodate your ways? I have come to understand the human brain and its two most basic limitations. The first being a physical limitation in the quantity and quality of information it is able to store. The second is a result of the limitations of its sensory organs in perceiving reality. The brain is, nevertheless, a remarkable feat of engineering, with approximately 100 billion neurons each firing at a rate of once every 3 seconds. On each occasion that one specific neuron fires a signal, this information will be received by 7,000 other neurons. Multiply these three figures, and you have 200,000 bits of information transmitted every second inside your brain, a figure whose proportions elude the imagination of most. My point, the brain is limited in its ability to record all of this information. With respect to the sensory organs, the eye can only perceive a very limited band of light known as the visible spectrum. The same sort of limitations exists in relation to time, sound, touch, smell, and hearing. Therefore, the brain is not able to detect the full scope of reality surrounding it. For example, if the brain can store 50% of the information that is out there in the real world, and my sensory organs can process only 50% of what reaches them, then the total product of information a person has is 25% of reality. Although our brain's memory is reduced in information, the brain is able to manipulate information and even produce it. This is perhaps best demonstrated in how we solve problems. For example, by bringing together two different memories and producing a third that may solve some need. Unfortunately, since memories are limited in information, and the process of linking two of them follows no natural law, the end result is an abstracted and artificial solution that will not necessarily prove to work in the real world. I now realize that the structures of the brain and those of reality are quite different things. Let us imagine that an understanding of the artificial world created by the human brain comes in the form of square blocks, with natural counterparts coming in the form of a ball. We might well imagine the blocks of our imagining to tumble and fall if built on reality. When building a square structure on a round reality, it immediately becomes unstable. According to such logic, anything humans can conceive of or build is ultimately doomed to be short-lived. We should rather try our best to look to the structures built by nature, which inevitably proves more durable than anything we could have built. In whatever we do, we should let nature set the path, because nature is the final authority on what is right and suitable. New chapter, title, The Way You Are. Your cyclical nature. You are a most self-contained system. Hardly anything comes into your system from outside, with the exception of sunlight and the occasional meteor. Rarely anything leaves you with the exception of a little reflected sunlight and an occasional molecule of air floating into outer space. What is the general logic of your cycles? They help us to explain how an atom or a chemical compound move through their environment, starting in one part and moving to another, only to return back to where they started with no or very little in terms of accumulation. There is an endless number of cycles taking place on and within you right now. The cycle that can be perceived most readily is the water cycle, which begins in the oceans, lakes, rivers, and on land, as water vapor ascending through the air and forming clouds. These clouds will in turn drift along until the moment they give in and fall in the form of rain, snow, or ice onto land to form streams, creeks, and rivers eventually emptying into lakes and oceans, or else are absorbed by the land. The water cycle takes a year or more to reach completion, and there are other cycles that may take less time or much longer. For example, your crust consists of tectonic plates of rock, sand, and mud, moving very slowly and colliding with one another. Science tells us that at their collision points, one plate with all its mud and sand can slip under another, producing extreme pressure and heat. This results in volcanic activity that throws molten rock from deep beneath up to the surface. The rock cools and over millions of years breaks down to mud and sand once again. Carbon dioxide also exists in the oceans, air, and underground. There is a balance of carbon dioxide between the atmosphere and the oceans, as the atmosphere and the oceans exchange carbon dioxide according to their temperatures and composition. Scientists like to talk about these as carbon dioxide cycles. A major cycle in this regard is the photosynthesis-respiration cycle of living matter in the biosphere. For plants, photosynthesis takes carbon dioxide and water to produce oxygen, sugars, and starches, upon which many, if not most, of the living depend on for energy. With respiration, the reverse can be observed. Oxygen and carbohydrates are combined, releasing carbon dioxide and water once again. The living cycles. In simplest of terms, life is a chemical reaction requiring energy. With a fixed amount of incoming energy from the sun hitting the planet's surface, lowering the amount of energy required for this chemical reaction to take place allows for a proliferation of life. If the reader asks how they might lower the amount of energy required for a chemical reaction, the answer would revolve around the availability of catalysts and enzymes as a biological catalyst. In most cases where an enzyme is required, reactions occur faster because they require less energy to activate the reaction. You can think of a catalyst as a tool like a wrench, which makes it so much easier to unscrew a nut. In summary, increased energy efficiency using tools, such as an enzyme, occurs when there are mutations in our offspring which lead to more efficient enzymes. As far as we are aware, the cycles discussed above are neither the rule nor the exception for the movement of matter on and within the Earth's mantle. However, they are certainly present in each species in their circulatory systems. Specific groups of species, such as those found in a forest, circulate matter too. One can say that energy drives the circulatory system of forests, for example. Without it, forests would collapse because each of its links, whether one species or a piece of inanimate matter, provides a tiny link in the recycling of life-giving nutrients. This makes them available for regeneration of the forest. When looking out a window or strolling through a park, the reader may observe trees, birds, grass, and bees, to name just a few of the life forms present in our surroundings. When focusing on a flower merely as an object, it may appear entirely independent of the other objects around it, but in reality, it is intimately connected with all other objects in its immediate vicinity. A clover, for example, needs soil to grow. As a mature plant, it later provides nourishment for the bison which roam the plains of the Midwest. The puma, meanwhile, later hunts out the bison for food. When it manages to bring one down, it drags what it can of the carcass to the shade of a tree to eat. Flies gather around the carcass to feed, lay eggs, and try to avoid the birds that feed on them. The above picture and explanation are obviously simplified, but they show how different species are so closely interlinked. A more accurate representation of the cyclical link between species is shown in the following graphic. When following the biological cycle pictured above in a clockwise direction, starting with the green bush at the top left, a story can be told of how nutrients flow from one species to another. First, the bush extracts water and minerals from the soil, and with the help of the sun and atmosphere, produces tender leaves which are consumed by the goat to build its muscle, maintain its growth, and hopefully also give birth. The goat in turn is consumed by the human in the picture. The leftovers from the goat are used by the fly to lay its eggs. Some birds will feed on those flies, while the goat, human, bird, and fly leave behind fecal matter that is consumed by various microbes such as amoebas and bacteria, which return the nutrients back to the soil once again. On any given territory, there are multitudes of life cycles, but perhaps with different species that participate in returning the atoms and chemical compounds, nutrients, back to the soil and into the atmosphere. In addition, these living cycles can often be interrelated. For instance, a living cycle that starts with a bush can have more than one grazer consuming it. They may be goats, sheep, or deer. Looking at a square acre of land and trying to describe the number of living cycles within it, one may count many millions of combinations. Living cycles are not limited to food either. They can be observed in relation to nest building, territory, and so on. The biological cycle graphic below shows the cycle for a bird building a nest in a tree. When the eggs hatch, the nest may fall to the ground where insects break it down and pass on the resulting matter to amoebas and bacteria, which will return the nutrients back to the soil to be used by the bush. This is a key point to introduce in any discussion on the concept of an ecosystem. A forest is an example of an ecosystem. Like any ecosystem, it contains megacycles of circular chains involving both the air, soil, water, plants, and animals. A forest is not the only ecosystem. A desert such as the Sahara Desert is also considered an ecosystem. In summary, the chain of life is circular, meaning that there is no start or end, no top or bottom link, nor is there any intelligent link or any particularly unintelligent one. The chain is nevertheless very complex. It contains many circular side chains. The chain is like a solid sphere where no one circular chain can be distinguished from another. Nature is complex. Humans are, in fact, incapable of grasping its full complexity. The reality is that humans are but one link in the chain of equal value to any other. The civilized must rid themselves of the notion they are more intelligent or somehow superior to any other life form. The civilized must learn humility and respect for the order and boundaries of nature. The mature species. When looking at the relationship between a lion and its prey, the gazelle, for example, the African lioness eats from the herd of gazelle to satisfy her hunger and the hunger of her pride. She hunts in a way that always leaves enough gazelle for her to pursue the next day and the next year. If she and her cohorts finished off the whole herd of gazelle, then her cubs will have nothing to eat the next day or year, and they will die off, resulting in their extinction. One key factor that gives stability to this living relationship is laziness. In the wild, it has been observed that lions sleep for 21 to 22 hours a day and go hunting for gazelle or other prey only when their bellies rumble. To conserve energy, lions pursue only the slowest individuals in the gazelle herd. If an element of laziness was not present in this pride of lions, one can imagine the lions hunting all day and bringing down as many gazelles as they can, which would ultimately break the living relationship between predator and prey. Other key factors to consider here are the territoriality of lions and the increasing speed of gazelles that protect themselves against overhunting. In summary, living relationships are stable over time, largely due to the genetics of their participants, which have mutated into a form that fits the environment. Unstable relationships in nature simply do not exist. New chapter. Title: The Assault. The Birth of Competing for More. Agriculture began independently in different parts of your abode, dear Earth, and encompassed the domestication of a whole range of taxonomies. At least 11 separate regions of the Old and New World would independently become centers of origin. In the Middle Ages, both in Islamic and European cultures, agriculture was transformed by improved farming techniques and the diffusion of crop plants, including sugar, rice, and cotton, along with fruit trees such as the orange, which first arrived in Europe by way of Al-Andalus in the Muslim-ruled south of the Iberian Peninsula in Europe. After 1492, Columbus's voyage would lead to the arrival of New World crops in Europe, such as maize, potatoes, sweet potatoes, and manioc, while Old World crops such as wheat, barley, rice, and turnips, and livestock including horses, cattle, sheep, and goats would travel to the Americas. Irrigation, crop rotation, and fertilizers were introduced with the Neolithic Revolution and developed much further over the past 200 years, starting with the British Agricultural Revolution. Since 1900, agriculture in the developed nations, and to a lesser extent in the developing world, has seen a great rise in productivity as human labor has been replaced by mechanization and assisted by synthetic fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and the selective breeding of plants and animals. The Haber-Bosch method allowed the synthesis of ammonium nitrate fertilizer on an industrial scale, greatly increasing crop yields. But modern agriculture has also raised political issues, including water pollution, biofuels, genetically modified organisms, tariffs, and farm subsidies, leading to alternative approaches such as the organic movement and regenerative agriculture. The transformation from hunter-gatherer. As the reader can imagine, Cultivating plants requires a more sedentary existence than that of the hunter-gatherer nomadic groups that roamed Earth's surface before the advent of agriculture. As certain communities started to improve their practice of cultivation and animal husbandry, a surplus developed. This surplus became the possession of the tribe, to be distributed according to tribal customs. Who should receive this surplus would become the question to initiate the first political power struggles as power shifted from the group to the leader. Territories became more firmly defended as these groups intensified their agricultural activities. Barter within the group and with other neighboring groups also increased. For example, there were instances when one group would ask for maize in exchange for wheat. Since the harvest season for these crops was different and storage was no guarantee against rodents or insects consuming the goods, it was difficult to make such transactions. What was needed was something to hold the value of the wheat until the maize was ready to be harvested and exchanged. A token would be used to hold the value of the wheat until the transaction could be completed. This token was exchanged for the wheat and returned when the maize was ready. These tokens later became known as monies. As techniques for agriculture improved, so did their surplus. In Europe, small groups and tribes were replaced by feudal landlords and serfs. The institutionalization of wanting more. The feudal landlord and serf system started to give way to urbanization across Europe approximately in the 2nd century AD. Towns were built and roads were laid to connect them together and to the land. As towns grew into cities, merchant capitalism developed, which involved capital resources used to hire people who were willing to exchange their labor for monies in order to work the land, providing a service or some handmade product. Merchant capitalism also included renting land, offering products on credit, and the lending of monies. Sir Francis Bacon, in the 1600s, among others, advocated the use of the scientific method in research. This ushered in the Industrial Revolution of the 1800s, with the invention of machinery driven by readily available fossil fuels, which would replace the more primitive biomass-dependent services and handmade products. The industrial capitalist age came to replace the feudal system of landlord and serf with two human organizations. The first was the town or city, such as London, where the masses needed goods. The second was the factory that used paid laborers to provide these goods. As far as the factory was concerned, capitalism involved the production of goods in exchange for monies, a process in turn driven by the needs and desires of consumers. Capitalism also had driven a growing desire for wealth and profit on the part of factory owners. With respect to the inhabitants of these towns and cities, capitalism had a dangerous aspect in the free market equation, namely the formation of monopolies. Laws were introduced to prevent such monopolies and encourage competition. This competition introduced a drive for innovation to reduce costs, find substitutes, and create new production technologies. With the advent of capitalism and competition, a slight increase in global population could be detected between 1500 to 1800 AD, as shown in the chart below. When the availability of fossil fuels became more abundant due to technological advances and competition in the capitalist market system, this resulted in the exponential growth of the civilized population from approximately 800 million in 1700 AD to 7.5 billion today. The increase in population count resulted in an increase in the consumption of resources extracted from your body, dear Earth. Many resources have begun to be depleted beyond sustainable levels and beyond economic viability. It was predicted in the publication Limits to Growth, the 30-year update, that the human population will plunge to approximately 2 billion or less, down from 9 billion in roughly 30 years, as a result of this shortage in more of your resources. The civilized capitalist system, with its singular focus on profit, has caused many devastating effects, which will be talked about later in this publication. We, the civilized, behaved as if we were the most important of your species. With this new fossil fuel power source, we set out to control our own destiny and attempt to tame the world. Instead of a naturally cyclical existence, we felt more comfortable with our straight lines. And so we built our square homes, towns, and cities. We plucked apart the jungles and built farms with machinery that could only go in one direction, and so farmland was divided into square and rectangular fields. Instead of forming a part of the circular food chain, we, the civilized, chose to sit at the top of a food pyramid. If a creature was thought to be useful to our existence, it was domesticated, and if it was not, it was ignored or eliminated. Instead of relying on nature's way of balancing population size with the environment, we developed an improved public health system that prolonged the life expectancy of the elderly by an additional 10 to 30 years. This medical revolution also led to an increase in the survival of newborns, causing an increase in the birth rate, resulting in the population to grow exponentially. Instead of being more efficient in our use of energy, we became less so, using huge quantities of fossil fuels. We built our own monetary systems based on increasing the profit margins of companies and individuals. This was achieved by teaching a need for material goods and services, while continuing to meet the public's demand for them. Energy was no longer such a precious resource, but simply a way to heat up economies that support growing and increasingly materialistic populations. Instead of being a part of the biosphere, we chose to be apart from it. Summary. Competition for resources to satiate the hunger of the masses and the accumulation of wealth by the industrial barons drove the invention and provision of more products and services for consumers. Competition also increased the quantities of goods and services available to every civilized consumer, aided by the now readily available fossil fuels. As a result, our populations have exploded. In your zero-sum world, something had to give, and it was not the insatiable wants of the civilized, but your inability to provide as resources dwindled. We, the civilized, have grown comfortable with our lifestyles, but we have painted ourselves into a corner that we seem unable to easily extract ourselves from, simply because we have lost the know-how to live close to nature. It is also a blind person's trap, because between those limited resources and we, the civilized, lies big business. Big business assumes solutions will eventually come down the pipeline to solve these shortage problems. So instead, they keep on doing their thing, accumulating profits while keeping us as their satisfied customers. New chapter. Title: The Aftermath. The Results of Civilized Human Activity. Current evidence indicates that we, the civilized, are returning climate conditions to their levels 60 million years ago, when global temperatures were higher, with a different atmospheric chemistry. There is no question as to whether civilized activities are driving this process by exhuming ancient fossil fuels. It is as if nature is pulling the civilized by the nose to show us the extent to which our current conditions are unsustainable and need to be reset. The civilized population boom. The civilized population has exploded from a few tribes in Africa 300,000 years ago to a global population count of 7.5 billion today, predominantly due to our activities. Today, 96% of the biomass of mammals on Earth consists of humans, their pets, and farm animals. If the ultimate achievement of a species is to increase its numbers, we might ask at this point, are there any negative side effects to the apparent success of the civilized? Extinctions. We are living through a crisis in biodiversity. The fastest mass extinction in your history, Earth, is happening right now, largely due to the actions of the civilized. 700,000 species have become extinct since 1976. This biodiversity crisis is snowballing, and many experts predict a sixth mass extinction is on the horizon. The habitats. With the domestication of a limited taxonomy of plants and animals, more and more lands are required to support them, which results in a loss of habitat for the rest of the plant and animal species of no interest to the civilized. For example, in the southern United States of America, beef cattle are raised on ranges where they compete with other indigenous species that naturally inhabit those areas. This competition is further weighted against them by the civilized population's tendency to kill by shooting or poisoning those undesirable species. Soil erosion and degradation. Natural processes moved rocks from their resting places, down hills and gullies through the power of wind and water currents, causing them to collide with each other. All these movements and collisions resulted in the formation of soils some 450 million years ago, when plants started to take root after evolving from much simpler organisms. Since then, soils have moved and developed through the very same processes. In general, a stable soil is where this movement removes soil from an area at roughly the same rate as soil is deposited. A much more recent problem is the loss of soils at a much faster rate than their deposition. This is the result of civilized human action, such as overgrazing or inappropriate cultivation practices. These actions leave the land vulnerable and unprotected. Soil may also be degraded by salination, nutrient loss, and compression due to other civilized activities such as agriculture and construction. The result of soil erosion and degradation is a reduction in soil fertility and its support of living plants and animals, including the human species. Deforestation. It has been estimated that approximately half of Bovlif, your mature tropical forests, dear Earth, between 2.9 to 3 million square miles of the original 5.8 to 6.2 million square miles that until 1947 covered the planet, have now been destroyed. Some scientists have predicted that unless significant measures are taken, such as seeking out and protecting old-growth forests around the world before 2030, there will only be 10% remaining, with another 10% in a degraded condition. 80% will have been lost, and with them millions of irreplaceable animal, plant, and insect species. Insecticides. Throughout most of human history, insects have been loathed. From locusts to termites and the weevil, they have gained a reputation as being detrimental to the interests of the civilized. Recently, however, some insects were discovered to be rather essential. The bee is just one example. It wasn't until its beneficial effects on pollination were discovered that an appreciation of its services to the civilized began to be recognized. Today, bees are in grave danger from the insecticides used by the civilized to protect plants from other insects and fungi. Honeybees are critical for pollinating food crops. Scientists say the disruption of pollination could dramatically affect entire ecosystems. Yet, there are many more insects and insect larvae that are critical to human existence. The depletion of global fisheries. A report entitled Status and Solutions for the World's Unassessed Fisheries by the Sustainable Fisheries Group, SFG, has confirmed suspicions held by many researchers that nearly 80% of the world's fisheries are in steep decline. The reasons for this decline are overfishing caused by a multitude of factors, including ignorant political decision-making process, an unmanaged commons, and technologies which improve detection and capture of marine wildlife. Invasive species. Invasive species are species that are transferred from one ecosystem to another, where they compete with native ones and take over their habitats. An increase in global trade has led to a further increase in the number of plant and animal species that are carried from one part of the globe to another, legally, illegally, or accidentally. Some of these species become pests and wreak havoc on their destination ecosystems, such as rabbits and mice in Australia, for example, and blackberries in the Americas, often reducing biodiversity and threatening ecological balance. Hazardous and toxic waste. Hazardous waste poses a substantial threat to public health and the environment. Worldwide, the United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, estimated that more than 400 million tons of hazardous waste are produced each year by industrialized countries, with about 4 million tons shipped across international boundaries. The majority of these transfers occur between industrialized countries and developing nations, where they are disposed of due to the rising cost of disposing of hazardous waste in the home country. Disposal consists of storage either above or below ground, leaving a legacy for future generations. In the case of biological toxins, they are often incinerated or simply released into the air. Water depletion. Groundwater is a valuable resource throughout the world. Where surface water such as lakes and rivers is scarce or inaccessible, groundwater supplies the needs of the civilized. Sustained groundwater pumping as a result of overpopulation causes groundwater depletion and is a key issue affecting groundwater use. Many areas of the world are experiencing groundwater depletion. Pumping lowers the water table, requiring drilling to greater depths, which in turn makes pumping more expensive. In addition, the reduction of water in streams and lakes is partly due itself to groundwater depletion, reduction of the water table, and climate change. Landslides also occur when water is removed from the soil. As a result, the soil collapses and compacts. The deterioration in the quality of fresh groundwater supplies is caused by saltwater intrusion from oceans, seas, deeper groundwater sources, and the water below the oceans that are all saline. If we consider that one hamburger takes about 635 gallons of freshwater to produce, the problem becomes clear. To look at water consumption on a different level, the average American household uses 107,000 gallons per day, 2012. Rainfall and snowfall not only replenish groundwater supplies, but also provide for year-round water sources for many communities by replenishing snow to mountains in the winter, that in turn provides water in the summer. However, our increasing usage of this rainwater due to water shortages proves a further problem. Global warming today, we are witnessing the very early stages of global warming and its effects, but there are signs we are on the road to more significant changes in weather and ocean patterns. There are many agricultural communities dependent on the annual melting of glacier ice and its subsequent replenishment. In addition, the ocean and sea levels have been rising at the rate of an inch every 10 years and are now accelerating. In the United States of America, forest fires are burning larger sections of land and are reaching higher up the mountains where there was once snow to slow them down. These fires are also burning at hotter temperatures, and trees such as the ponderosa pines that depend on fires are also dying from the extreme heat these new fires generate. Nitrous oxides play an important role in atmospheric chemistry. They are emitted into the atmosphere naturally, mainly as a result of microbial activities in soils and lightning discharges. Today, emissions predominantly occur as a result of civilized activities such as the combustion of fossil fuels, biomass burning, and the use of fertilizers. Long-term trends of nitrous oxide concentration in the atmosphere are not documented adequately. Nevertheless, reconstructed emission inventories suggest that large increases have occurred throughout this century. Exposure to nitrous oxides has direct adverse effects on humans, animals, and plants. Nitrous oxides also contribute to the global environmental problems facing our planet, i.e., excessive global warming, depletion of the ozone layer, and acid rain. Antibiotics and the superbugs. Antibiotic resistance is a serious and growing problem in today's medical industry, and has become one of the imminent public health concerns of this century. In the simplest cases, organisms acquire resistance through mutations that make them immune to common antibiotics, thereby requiring the use of less common secondary antibiotics. Primary antibiotics are preferred due to their safety, availability, and cost. Secondary antibiotics are broader in spectrum, pose higher risks, and may be more expensive or difficult to source. In the case of some multiple drug-resistant pathogens, resistance to secondary and even tertiary antibiotics have been demonstrated, illustrated by pathogens Staphylococcus aureus and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which possess a high level of intrinsic resistance. The main cause of widespread antibiotic resistance is the overuse of antibiotics by the civilized in agriculture and in the health field. It is becoming harder and harder to fight infections caused by these drug-resistant pathogens, and their increase in number and prevalence is outpacing man's ability to fight them. Summary: we are losing the race with time to save your precious cargo, Earth. In 1993, Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson estimated that you are losing about 30,000 species per year, or 3 species per hour. There is no doubt the civilized are the direct cause of this habitat loss and the extinction of species through such events as overpopulation, the transformation of the landscape through agriculture, construction, and uncontrolled forestry practices, overexploitation of species and habitats, pollution, global warming, and the introduction of alien species into existing ecosystems. In other words, the self-proclaimed ideal species of the planet has run amok. New chapter. Title: The Apology. The Amazon is burning because we are not good stewards of the land. The seas and oceans are becoming depleted of life because we are not good stewards of the waters. The air we breathe is becoming polluted because we are not good stewards of the atmosphere. We were never meant to be stewards of anything, but instead to be managed by nature. In addition, there is one thing we must realize here, and that is that nature makes no promises. There are many examples of evolutionary dead ends, in which a species or a cluster of species simply die off when their habitats no longer exist or are unable to support them. So where do I start? Where should I begin? The issue is so vast. But Earth, your pain compels me to write and to try to find an explanation. I am not to blame, and yet I am responsible. I have departed from your natural path and find myself with my head in the clouds, unable to see the reckless approaches in my advances, treading on your hallowed grounds in ignorance. I now must confess, take accountability for my actions and the actions of those who preceded me in my civilized family, for we have created this great burden you now carry. I have peeked through the fog, and I have seen a light which is bright and hard. Yet, it has taken hundreds of years to get to where we have gotten, and I have but a few years left in my life to help some of the civilized to at least give this light a second glance. So, I lower my brow and look to my feet and to the ground I am standing on, for that is the focus of my salvation. Then I look up at the sky and observe the sun, for there is the essence that could have led us to the way intended for us. You and the sun were the yin and yang of that which is sacred to life. I hear your screams clearly, and I am ashamed, but yet I cannot help it. I have gotten used to my lifestyle now, and even if I decide to follow the path of recovery, there is nowhere to start. For I and the civilized have done away with your conventions and transformed you into an alien landscape. There is nowhere to go physically to start the journey that leads to you. Oh, how I wish I had started my journey to you long, long ago. So here I am, writing and hoping at least one of the civilized will read of you and somehow understand my message, lowering their heads below the clouds to breathe some fresh air and see the simple truth. It was not about wealth, power, or technology. It was about the wisdom of nature and how it balances you and the sun in the dance of life. It should have all come naturally, but civilization's foreign ways distorted man's vision away from reality. I dream of the day that enough of the civilized start to see the truth of nature's way and help in restoring dignity to you and our lives, so that we are with you once again. Oh, how I lament my outlandish ways. I imagine they will slowly turn their minds to you, and then perhaps will come a final and very physical appreciation of the marvel that is you. How I wish that reality would sink in, that they would become conscious more and more of what has been lost. It is not a matter of thinking of nature in a positive way. That is not enough. What is needed is to be able to stand naked in a forest and consider it home. You see, when I actively think of nature, I detract from nature's gift. For I am nature, in and out. I belong to nature and not the other way around. I should not have built monuments, for nature was the builder. I should not have provided anything such as agriculture, for you were always the provider. All we needed was you and the vibrantly bright sun to make happiness available to all. Why should we have taken aim at the heavenly stars when heaven was here in your arms? Why should we have sought wealth when all was given freely? Why should we have pursued power when it was readily available from the sun? Why should we have pursued technology, for it only kept my head dreaming of the impossible? Who gave the civilized the right to dump waste in your oceans, seas, lakes, and rivers? From garbage to sewage and forever chemicals, we have been polluting your waterways beyond their ability to process the processable, thinking these waterways to be ours to poison as we saw fit. Who gave the civilized the right to fish your oceans, seas, lakes, and rivers, as if the fish were ours to take at any cost? Who gave the civilized the right to suck up all your rivers and groundwaters that other species depend upon, as if these waters were ours to do with as we pleased? Who gave the civilized the right to pollute the air and change the climate? Who gave the civilized the right to tear down your forest lands for its timber, scarring your beautiful face with roads and bridges? Who gave the civilized the right to gouge deep holes in your precious complexion to accommodate our hunger for your minerals? In actuality, no one has given the civilized those rights, but instead we have proclaimed them as a right through which to pursue happiness. Our brains perceived a mirage in which we were more valuable than any other of your beings. If it came to a choice between you and the life of a civilized person, the well-being of that person would somehow be considered first. It is not enough to plant a vegetable garden and call it organic just to demonstrate positive thinking towards nature. It is not enough to abstain from using chemicals to help grow and protect those vegetables. It is not enough to turn away from the use of motorized implements to plow the fields. Nor is it enough to grow the vegetable garden with sustainable means such as composting for soil conditioning and fertilization, plant rotation to avoid soil mineral depletion, or drip irrigation to conserve water. All of these practices ultimately involve imperfect inventions. The idea of the civilized growing plants was an alien inkling. At best, we should have let it wither away from our minds. Plants grow on their own in the places where they are best suited. Humans really do not need to do anything for plants to naturally flourish. Nature is the provider of all that is good and healthy for the living. For nature is 4 billion years wiser than any of us arrogant representatives of civilization. Sure, nature has tried and failed, but it then tried again until it got it right. No amount of civilized ingenuity or technology will ever replace the astute methods of nature, because nature will always be billions of steps ahead of us. We should have given up our egotistical ways long ago and submitted to nature's authority. For humility is the only way to think positively about you. We should have been wise and considered ourselves part and not apart from your living cycles, the web of life, and its ecosystems. Notions that humans are at the top of the food chain and humans have a superior intelligence are vocalizations of an ego desperate to ensure humanity's survival. We are but a link, no better or worse than any other, be it a clump of mud or another species in your organization of life. The interference of my intellect and that of the civilized has fed our egos, leading us astray and blinding us to their consequences. The more we took, the less was left for others whom we depend upon. There are two ways of turning back. One is to forgo the notions of superiority, perform some kind of lobotomy, and kill these inappropriate opportunistic impulses. The other is to engage the pursuit of your salvation through a more respectful lifestyle akin to that of the lion and the gazelle. This mature lifestyle has been alive for many millennia in the human species. There are numerous indigenous tribes that practiced it and who considered themselves part of their environment. For example, the Mbuti people living in the Ituri forest, a tropical rainforest covering about 27,000 square miles of the north-northeast section of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Africa. The Mbuti are pygmy hunter-gatherers, one of the oldest indigenous people of the Congo region. They are composed of bands ranging from 15 to 60 people, with a total population of around 30,000 to 40,000 individuals. The forest is the center of Mbuti life. They consider the forest to be their great protector and provider and believe that it is a sacred place. They sometimes call the forest mother or father. An important ritual exists which is referred to as Molimo. After the death of an important person in the tribe, Molimo is noisily celebrated to wake up the forest in the belief that if bad things are happening to its children, it must be asleep. As with many Mbuti rituals, the time it takes to complete a Molimo is not rigidly set. Instead, it is determined by the mood of the group. Food is collected from each hut to feed the Molimo, and in the evening the ritual is accompanied by dancing and singing by the men who gather around the fire. Women and children must remain in their huts with the doors closed. These practices were studied and introduced in the publication The Forest People, Turnbull, 1962. Conclusion: now that the damage has been done and the point of no return from extinction is fast approaching, what can we say but regret listening to our inner voices that said, take whatever you want? How could we have been so blind as to reject all of those examples around us of the way that other species or people have managed their abodes? I am sorry for what we have done to you by defiling the waterways, laying waste to the landscapes, and making the air the repository of toxins. I'm sorry for my arrogant attitude towards you. I'm sorry the present and preceding generations of the civilized nurtured and took care of their own at the expense of your dignity. It seems such a sure sign of success for a short period, but not indeed for long. and now the civilized and the rest of your creation stand at the very door of the void. The End. Copyright 2021 by Hassan A. Rashid, all rights reserved. No part of this book may be reproduced or transmitted in any form by any means, graphic, electronic, or mechanical, including photocopying, recording, taping, or by any information storage retrieval system, without the written permission of the author. For further information, contact ostam@yahoo.com, ISBN 978-1-365-599712, LCCN 1-365-599-71X. Published in the United States of America.